This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
We're really getting into now the streaming's arms race.
Dish is looking at that and saying we can really build a nice niche for ourselves.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The dollar is the dominant currency in the planet.
I think the acquisition is a natural progression of what Microsoft can do with this technology going forward.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we're going to take a look at the cap for commodities as you still see bond yields trending lower.
Plus, the global vaccine campaign, it gets complicated. How does the contagious Delta variant change the outlook for booster shots?
Complicated sounds like the simple answer. But first, we want to start with the Fed. It was the big news of the week. There was something for the hawks. There was something for the doves in the presser and the Fed statement. So we want to get more from Ira Jersey, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist. What was there for you, Ira?
Yeah, so I agree with you, Alex. It was a little bit for everybody in there. I think the big takeaway is kind of stay the course for now, but the Fed did take a baby step toward reducing its asset purchases. So it looks like they are thinking still about tapering, even with some of the risks that are coming up with the Delta variant and lack of vaccinations in some areas.
So, Ira, what's the market discounting as to timing when we start to see some meaningful tapering?
Yeah, so the market's discounting still the first quarter of next year. You don't see that very much in the markets because I think that there's a risk here that the market's trying to adjust to asset purchases going away, but at the same time, the potential for the economy to be somewhat slower than we thought before. So when you look at 10-year bond yields, you have to remember there's two components to the 10-year bond yield. One is inflation expectations. So where does the market think inflation is going to be on average over the next decade? And then the other side ends up being growth, right? So where does the market think we're going to see economic activity and how robust and volatile will that be? So right now, the market's expecting a little over, just about 2.5% inflation, but it's expecting GDP growth to be much lower, I think, than the economists are currently forecasting. And that'll be interesting to see how that's resolved eventually, because if the economists are right, bond yields are far too low for the pace of economic activity in 2022 and 2023.
So based on all of that, I feel like a week ago, Jackson Hole could have been seen as somewhat live in some capacity. Is Jackson Hole no longer live?
Well, I think it's live insofar as there's the possibility that Chair Powell might, lay out some kind of framework as to the pace and how the actual structure of taper will be. But the timing, they'll still leave very vague. And I think, that's been the modus operandi for the Federal Reserve over the last couple of years. So Jackson Hole maybe was going to be live, but I think, let's face it, Jay Powell last Wednesday was pretty clear in the fact that they are talking about it, but that they haven't made a decision as to when they're going to do it. And in fact, if you read the statement, the post-meeting statement, it did say coming meetings. Mm-hmm. So, we're really parsing the statement in
Get that S in there, man.
But that S at the end of meetings means, they're not going to announce anything until November, because there's only a meeting in September and then next meeting's in November. So that's probably the first meeting that you have to think that they're going to announce a taper.
I think, Alex, I need to be out of Jackson Hole, if for no other reason than carry Michael McKee's bag, luggage, and that type of thing.
Yeah,
what do you think?
Yeah, you say that now, but it's hard to get there, man. You might not enjoy carrying his luggage.
Oh, we're not getting the surveillance Gulfstream, I guess. All right, so interesting. So, Ira, when we do see the tapering, what's it going to look like?
Yeah, so I think first they probably will taper mortgage-backed securities and treasuries at the same time, and more or less at the same not at the same pace nominally, because they are buying twice as many treasuries as they're buying mortgages, but they'll cut something like $20 billion a month for 6 months, or they'll do $10 billion a month for 12 months. It's something like that that the Fed will decide to do. I think the market reaction will be very interesting, because when we first talked about this back in January, February, when we first got an inkling that maybe the economy was going to get better and the Fed was going to reduce asset purchases, we saw a 100 basis point sell-off in 10-year yields.
Mm-hmm.
So You know, will we repeat that? No, probably not. In fact, our work in a note that I just put out on Friday, we estimate that it's around 45 basis points is the effect on the 10-year yield that the Fed is having. So when you think about where rates might go just on taper, you're talking, you know, maybe 160, 170 on the 10-year yield. So not crazy high, but still higher than where we are today.
Why? Why only 45 basis points?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, one of the big ones is, and that's based on an econometric model that I built, so it's very empirical. But basically, fair value right now for real yields on 10-year TIPS yields, it's around negative 75 basis points. And the reason for that is, like I mentioned, the market is pricing for low volatility in the economy. It's pricing for the budget deficit to remain relatively high over coming years. And, you know, an infrastructure bill announcement doesn't help that.
So, Ira, I mean, if we look at the 10-year Treasury, boy, it's just been kind of hovering in that 1.25 to 1.3 range, give or take a little bit. Are we more likely to see a 1% 10-year before we see a 2% 10-year?
So I still think that we're more likely to see a 2% 10-year than a 1. That being said, you know, we wind up with another variant that winds up being more deadly, and, you know, that gets blown out of the water because we have more lockdowns, and, you know, we wind up having another, hopefully we never go back to 2020, but, you know, there's a lot of risks out there.
Ira, thanks a lot. Really appreciate your time. Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist Ira Jersey.
Coming up on the program, why the next COVID-19 peak may spark a strong rotation back to risk. That's next.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on your terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, COVID is not going anywhere, apparently. We've got the Delta variant, and it's wreaking havoc in different degrees, different levels in different parts of the world. But the market continues to pay close attention to the pandemic and to the changes and the surges, and it's clearly been an issue for equity markets. Let's turn to Gina Martin-Adams. She's a senior equity strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. I mean, Gina, we're 18 months into this thing, but the market has still got a big, big focus on the pandemic and what it means for the economy, what it means for central banks, and it's just something that the market continues to be focused on.
Yeah, and it certainly is showing up in relative regional performance as well as relative sector performance. What we've noted is over the course of the last year, every time infections rise, U.S. stocks outperform, and specifically within the U.S. market, usually tech is the predominant outperforming sector as a result of more defensive strategies sort of taking over. And that's exactly what we've seen over the course of the last 5 or 6 weeks. Once again, U.S. stocks taking off. The trouble with that is at some point these defensive sort of moves become too expensive for investors to tolerate. And I fear that we're at that critical point right now with earnings rolling in. We start to really get a sense that some of these strategies are, while still producing earnings growth, not producing record-level earnings growth, nor expected to, and are undershooting market expectations. And so the result is a lot of volatility probably emerges as some of these defensive trades become a little bit overblown.
So in terms of earnings, which we have to pair the micro and the macro at the same time, like, how does big tech stack up when it comes to pricing power and dealing with inflationary risks? Because that could help be the offset.
Yeah. Actually, not well, Alex.
Really? I'm surprised.
You find it historically, first, in terms of earnings, tech sector earnings are expected to pair right along, basically match market pace over the course of the next 12 months, where several other more cyclically oriented sectors probably experience market gains. And part of the reason for that is pricing power starts to shift to sectors that can tolerate inflation gains a little bit better. Tech is okay when it comes to pricing power. It's not perfect, and certainly historically, actually, some segments of tech have shown very strong inflation sensitivity, semis being one of them. This is part of the story that I think is underappreciated that's going on with the semiconductor space. While we're all obsessed with supply chain, and certainly supply chain is a big driver of some of these inflation risks, this sector is not just this time, but almost every time, one of the segments that tends to suffer when inflation starts to pick up.
So, Gina, you know, we've been talking really since the beginning of this pandemic about, you know, do I stick with the big growth names that have worked so well for me, you know, really since the great financial crisis, or do I kind of rotate into some cyclical names? When you talk to fund managers, how quickly can they pivot, or is it just simply a shadings? You know, I want to be shading a little bit overweight tech or shading a little overweight energies and banks.
It's still very much a shading, and I think the reason why it is a shading and the sort of this really slow move out of some of last cycle's drivers into some other segments is twofold. The first is a lack of belief, right, that something has really materially changed. And that lack of belief, you know, only takes time to change. But for now, investment managers are generally somewhat reticent to remove their holdings or reduce their holdings of last cycle's winners, which makes sense. They worked for a very, very long period of time. To viciously rotate out of them is a pretty risky strategy. But then secondly is just sort of the sort of core fundamentals of how portfolio management works is you tend not, unless you're you know, a certain segment of the portfolio management industry, most of them are not going to move on a dime. It's going to take a considerable amount of time. It's going to take a sequence of economic data prints that, you know, changes over years, not months, to create a longer-term shift in strategy. And we saw this play out before, right? Everyone was overweight tech and high growth, large cap growth headed into the 2000 peak. That crisis reduced those holdings, but then we saw over the period of the next 3 or 4 years, a reduction in holdings of tech relative to other segments of the index as a more value-oriented rotation took hold. I'm not saying that this is the exact same as that period of time, but if a more inflationary environment driven by, you know, stronger growth prospects emerges over the course of this cycle, you will see portfolios shift in accordance with that new sort of economic regime.
So where does that leave small caps?
Yeah, small caps are somewhat dependent on a number of things. I think small caps, unfortunately, got a little bit overblown as a result of the fact that spreads were just falling materially from early spring last year to the spring of this year. We saw spreads move from very, very large level, very, very wide levels to back to cycle troughs, basically, and that created a tremendous tailwind for small caps. That now has kind of gone away. We're back at those cycle troughs. There's not a lot of room to move in high-yield spreads. So small caps have kind of been just spurting ever since the spring. What I think needs to happen for small caps going forward is we do need to see that revenue growth improve. And investors are somewhat cautious right now with respect to where revenue growth is going to go into the next 2 or 3 years. I think the fundamental underpinnings are very strong for a long-tailed revenue cycle to develop. For the global economy, let alone the U.S., and that should generally benefit small caps. But we do need to see that develop as we move from sort of peak growth conditions this summer into a new normal environment. Where will small caps head? It'll depend upon how fast growth is.
And that's kind of where I think a lot of fund managers and investors are right now, Gina. They're trying to figure out what's going to be the new normal on the back, you know, end of this pandemic. How do I think about 22, 23? How are you thinking about it?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the key issue that we're all contending with. I think about it as a new cycle, and every cycle is very different. I think it's highly unlikely we go back to the cycle that existed in 2010 to 2019 for one massive reason, and that is the degree to which policy has shifted. The Fed is very clearly committed to letting inflation run hotter than they have in the past. They want to pursue maximum employment to a more inclusive and broad-based level. That in and of itself is a very big shift that implies they are going to allow inflation to run hotter and target an average inflation pace as opposed to 2% as a cap.
Thanks to Gina Martin Adams, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Equity Strategist.
Coming up on the program, the global vaccination campaign gets complicated with the Delta variant.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BIGO on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
Does the world need a booster? Now, if you take a look at the recent studies out of Israel, it seems like the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine has lower efficacy at 39%, as they called it, when it comes to the Delta variant. But it's really high efficacy when it comes to preventing hospitalizations and preventing a severe case of the disease. So what does that all mean for everybody else? Well, who are we going to talk to? Of course, Sam Fazzelli, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Pharmaceutical Analyst. Sam, do we need boosters?
I think the best way I can put it is if the world continues to focus on cases and not severity of the infections, then you would continue to need a way of reducing the number of cases. Vaccinated people will get a mild infection, can get a mild infection, obviously at a much lower rate than unvaccinated people. And it's possible that over time, which is what the Israeli data appears to show, that protection against mild infection wanes because your shield of antibodies wanes. If we continue to be fully focused on that, and that seems to be the case today, then I guess we will need boosters.
Kind of, why is the UK data better than Israel?
So there are a couple of hypotheses. Let's assume, remember, this isn't published data from Israel. This is data that's shown quite nicely, Paul, by the Ministry of Health, but it's not published, so we don't know the methodologies, etc., behind it. Let's assume the Israeli data is correct. The differences between what Israel did and what the UK did is Israel got to, let's give it a number, 50% full vaccination of its population around the, if I'm not wrong, March, April time, whereas it took the UK till about July. So a lot more people have had recent vaccinations in the UK versus Israel. And then the other difference is obviously the UK used a longer interval between doses versus Israel. Israel went with the 3 to 4 weeks that is recommended. So those two aspects may have something to do with it.
So you mentioned something, though, earlier about if we still focus on infections rather than hospitalizations, booster is going to be the way to go. Why hasn't the narrative shifted to hospitalizations rather than infections?
Well, so that's interesting, Alex, because if you think about it, the UK has kind of shifted the narrative a little bit for its own population, saying, look, we're going to have to learn to live with this virus. Let's completely open up. We've broken the link between infections and severe disease, which is what is being shown. And so let's go ahead now and try and see whether we can live in freedom or as openly as possible without major issues. And the data went, the cases went sky high and then falling just as rapidly as they did. So what is that about? Lots of discussions there. But that, at least, has done it. The point I'm trying to make, though, is that the UK has done it. But in order to decide who comes and goes inside within the UK, from elsewhere to the UK, they look at case counts elsewhere.
So, Sam, I mean, let's assume that the world decides, or many parts of the world decide, that a booster shot at some point is needed. Is there a supply to satisfy that?
But if you use the boosters, you're basically taking it away from the rest of the world, which there are some countries that haven't even passed 2 or 3% vaccination rates. If we do continue to worry about just basic infections as opposed to severe disease, then we will have to use boosters.
That's such a poignant point. I wonder if there's another way to look at it, too. For those that aren't vaccinated where the Delta variant is spreading, what measures can be taken on the ground to prevent the spread so we can contain the variant and sort of help that along?
Yeah, so if you're talking, Alex, about countries such as the U.S., where vaccination rates have slowed down massively, and there are loads of people who don't want to get vaccinated, that's a very different conversation to if you're talking about another country which hasn't even had any vaccines to vaccinate people. So with regards to the U.S., I'm afraid I would suggest, and I'm going to be hated for this, I accept it, that the way to go about this is to incentivize vaccinations. One way to incentivize vaccinations, handing out guns and giving them million-dollar checks is one way, but the other way to say is, look, you make a choice, fair enough, we're not mandating you take your vaccine, but if you want to go into this house or that house or this restaurant or that theater, I'm afraid you have to be double vaccinated. So that's one way. In countries that don't, until we get a drug therapy that's easily manufacturable that can reduce the risk of severe infections, which unfortunately will be another few months if it works, then the only way is to continue with non-pharmaceutical interventions such as lockdowns, serious masking, etc., which is wearing people down.
Sam, so much more to talk about. We appreciate the time. Sam Fazzelli, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Pharmaceutical Analyst.
Coming up on the program, we turn to emerging markets and find out how China's crackdown on tech, education, and property impacts the broader EM universe.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BIGO on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Let's talk emerging markets. We've got China roiling these emerging markets, both abroad here in the States, but also around the world. And that, you know, really is a concern if you're an emerging market investor, because as goes China, so goes a lot of the emerging markets. When we talk EM, we talk to Damian Sassauer. He's a chief emerging markets credit analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Damian, let's step back and just, I'd love to get your overview of what China is doing in terms of some of these U.S.-listed companies that are huge. And it's really just calling the question, oh my goodness, can I invest in Chinese companies or anything?
Well, it really covers four major sectors, Paul. I mean, it covers big tech, banking, property, and most recently education. And so, you know, most people are focusing on the impact on equity markets, on domestic Chinese equity markets, which makes sense, right? We've had three big bubbles in China, really, since the global financial crisis. The first one, which was 2007 to 2008, 70% drawdown in China. The second one, 2015, when the RMB was devalued by the PBOC, 40%. In 2018, the trade war, 30%. Now we're down 18% peak to trough since February, and people are asking why. So beginning with really big tech, it's been a lot of the antitrust, it's been data privacy. Those are the things that the Chinese government are focused on. And so they're, you know, slapping fines on companies like Alibaba, Tencent, what have you. And they're really making lives difficult. And most of those companies, their stocks are now down anywhere from 30 to 50% since February. I mean, if you kind of expand that and you look at some of the online food platforms like Meituan, or you look at the ride-hailing service DD, again, you're seeing, you know, 50% drawdowns. These are huge companies, and China represents 50% of the broad, you know, $13 trillion emerging market equity universe. So clearly the impact is being felt abroad. There is a bit of contagion there. But as you know, I'm a fixed income guy, so what I like to focus on are credit spreads. And, you know, my goodness, I mean, the dislocation we're witnessing now is second to none. I mean, I think if you look at China investment grade corporate credit, spreads are now on par with that of Russian IG, Columbia IG. These are triple B minus rated entity, you know, kind of sectors relative to China, which is single A minus, three notches higher. So, I mean, the impact is pretty broad based, and it extends to high yield, which, don't get me started. I mean, China bonds account for 62% of the distressed emerging market universe now. They account for 25% of all emerging market debt, yielding 7% or more. So if you need some incremental yield, Paul, you now know where to find it.
Well, that's sort of my question here. So is that, are the spread widening justified, or is that just money that didn't understand risks that are that's coming out? Well, or are we going to see higher yields no matter what, because there's a risk here that every investor has to reprice?
Look, the emerging market debt universe isn't entirely as liquid as equities, right? So yeah, you know, it overshoots, and it overshoots to the downside, and this creates opportunities for investors. But, you know, I mean, Kyle Bass, you know, just this week was saying, you know, it's going to be very, very difficult as a fiduciary, as an RIA, you know, as a portfolio manager, to justify investing in Chinese entities, because the financials are, quite frankly, not what they're cooked to believe, and the economic data is not what, you know, they would have you believe. At least that's what a lot of the prevailing thought is. And so, you know, I adhere to that, and it's going to be a real challenge, and they're setting themselves up for litigation.
But I mean, if I'm an emerging market investor, I have to be in China, don't I?
You have to.
I have to be in China. So am I just gonna, like, kind of going to Alex's question? I'm just going to reprice everything. If you want my money, and maybe last year it was X percent, it's going to have to be 2X.
Absolutely.
You know, you're going to have to pay me.
And again, like, you know, we've seen this before. You know, I mean, the thing that's different this time around is, you know, you had these 70, 40, 30% drawdowns, you know, in previous cycles where we had, you know, the market blow up in China. You're not seeing that this time. And there's one reason for that. The currency has held up nicely. And all of those previous drawdowns, it's been the yuan coupled with equity and bond valuations coming off that's really giving you that pain, that poor P&L. This time, the yuan's kind of so far upholding itself, right? And that kind of takes me to the next segment. You know, what is going to drive EM currencies? And really, there are two things right now that are driving EM currencies. One, it's reflation, or, you know, the belief that we're going to have this reflationary cycle. I mean, in our belief here at BI, you know, we think we're mid-cycle. You know, we think, you know, there's still going to be plenty of liquidity from the Fed, and we think it's going to be, you know, slower but not sluggish growth, right? That's more mid-cycle. But, you know, if you just kind of take a step back and you look at what currencies are looking at, they're looking at reflation, they're looking at inflation, they're looking at that, and they're looking at vaccination rates. And prior to just, you know, call it March, you really didn't have data coming out of the emerging market landscape that really gave you any confidence one way or the other that these economies were going to recover from the vaccine and at what rate they were recovering. Now we see that, and we're seeing a real dichotomy between those with high vaccination rates and those with medium and low vaccination mm-hmm. rates, and that's reflected in the currency performance.
Well, yeah, you can just look at what the IMF said about the global growth forecast this week, which just showed the divergence between emerging markets and developed markets based on vaccination rates. Imagine then the divergence within emerging markets. If I'm not an emerging market investor, do I still need to own China?
I mean, absolutely. I think
you do, right? You do no matter what.
But it's where do you go? And so, you know, if you do believe, like I do, that, you know, the PBOC firmly has their finger on the thumb of the currency, you know, they're not going to let it fall out of bed, at least not that quickly.
Has their finger on the thumb of the currency.
Sorry. Yeah. They have their finger on the button of something. But, you know, let's call it. They've got the yuan well in hand, and they understand the economy is not growing because of the Delta variant, because Sinovac isn't as effective, you know, that they are going to have, you know, the virus isn't going away anytime soon. They're going to need to stimulate. They're going to need to cut rates. That's a great environment to own local currency denominated China government debt, CGBs, which I like to say are the JGBs for millennials. So if you're going to pick your spot, that's where you're going to go. You're not going to buy China Inc. You're not going to buy dollar denominated kung fu bonds from China corporates that have keepable provisions that are really just a handshake saying, hey, we're going to pay you back when things go bad. No, you're not going to do that. And I think that's really what Kyle Bass and some of these others are referring to.
All right, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Emerging Market Credit Analyst Damian Sassauer, thanks so much.
All right, let's turn now to the commodity space. A couple interesting things have been happening. One, you had some of the heavy metals, like nickel, for example, or steel, trade a little heavy. Maybe you're going to see an export tax on steel from China. You also saw gold kind of going nowhere fast, copper getting hit a little bit. What's all going on here? Is it fundamental, or is it just sort of position trading? I want to welcome Bloomberg Intelligence commodity strategist Mike McGlone. Have commodities peaked?
Yes.
Why?
The combination of things that are needed for commodities to go higher is very unlikely. First of all, it needs a higher stock market, needs a weaker dollar. Stock market's most stretched by most measures in history. The dollar's had a significant dip in a long enduring bull market. And I can talk about that later, but my point indication for the dollar is it's going to go back to that long enduring trend. And then you look at the shorter term things like more granularity. Look, you mentioned copper. Copper's probably peaked around $10,000 a ton. China's put the kibosh on it, and just what China just did, they just lowered the reserve rate. There's a high correlation between a lower reserve rate in China and lower commodity prices. Corn has probably peaked around $7. Crude oil's probably peaking around $75 a barrel, and crude oil's the big one in the space. So to me, that old mantra, the cure for higher prices in commodities is higher prices, is kicking in.
Okay. So we talk about, that's exactly where I wanted to go, to oil. It seems, I understand the demand side of the equation. Presumably the world is opening, reopening slowly, maybe more slowly than people would like. So that's good for demand. But it seems like OPEC Plus is kind of hanging in there. There's some discipline.
Well, that they have to.
Okay.
That's the only way for it to, for crude oil to stay this price, is OPEC Plus has to maintain that discipline. I enjoyed that narrative recently about how OPEC was having issues and how that was bullish for crude oil. I'm like, I did not understand that completely, because they're a cartel. They deliberately hold supply of the market, and their spare capacity is the highest ever. And our database is only going back 30 years. So that's a problem. At some point, that's coming on the market, and just what's human nature?
Right.
These are individual countries that need money. Okay, so look at that fact. And price is already bringing on. And then we also have U.S. shale. The cost of production of U.S. shale right now is $35 a barrel on the Bloomberg Terminal. That's the lowest in our database since 2014. Yet the price is the highest versus that cost in our database. So what does that mean? You have to ignore free market capitalism for expect crude oil supply just to not do what it was doing before, which was overwhelming demand. And then let's look in the big picture. I drive an electric car, but I'm rare. The whole world's going to be driving electric cars in 5 and 10 years. It's just what's happening with demand. Demand's been lackluster. It was lackluster before COVID. Now we've had the bounce. Let's go back to reality of the world is we don't need much petroleum. And by the way, we're creating much more of it than ever. And I'll end on one thing. It's the bane of commodity investors since the beginning of time, rapidly advancing technology, creating more supply than we actually use, and replacing it with different sources.
Okay, you just said it. You talked about EVs. So I can see how that would be a detriment to oil demand. But what about copper? Because if copper peaked, where's my copper supercycle thesis? In theory, it was as we decarbonize the world, we're going to need more copper. Because we're decarbonizing the world, there's going to be some mines that are not going to be able to turn on the copper like they would have before, hence supercycle.
The key way I look at copper is it's the main commodity that has to go up for the whole commodity base to go up because it has that story behind it. Rapidly advancing technology favors the metals. If there's any sector I'm bullish on, it's got to be the metals, partly because they're easy to store, because all this technology means more demand for it. But as our copper analyst out of London, Grant Spoyer, would point out, we have just too much copper. It's easier to bring it on supply, even in ESG format. And guess what? China just put the kibosh on it. And that's a key factor. China's been the biggest source of demand for copper for most notably the last 10 years, and they're turning around. Like I said, watch what they say.
What is China specifically doing as relates to the demand side?
They released some supply.
Okay.
So as far as demand
copper,
side.
I mean, other metals too. They just don't want that high prices. It hurts them when they're an import.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So they're secure.
Yep.
And also, it's just prudent money management. Copper is right now is the same price it was 10 years ago.
But isn't it more the developed world, like the West, that's leading the decarbonization push in some capacity? So China isn't as important as it was 12 years ago.
Absolutely, good point. There's one thing. Let's look what happened with copper in the U.S. 100 years ago. We advanced and we put in all these electric wires around the whole world. The world is advancing past that. For instance, in rural China, they're just putting in solar panels. Mm-hmm. And they don't need all the wires for electricity, for lights, and for their phones. But yes, it's really more EVs. I really believe in the demand side. So I think copper is stabilized. It's put in a peak around 10,000, just like crude oil on 75. So it's got to sustain above 10,000 for any hope of appreciating commodities. Otherwise, right now, it's below that. And I don't see a lot of upside, at least in the near term. And here's the key thing about copper. The PhD in economics. Bond yields have been declining. That's been an indication of lower copper, and it's completely subject to a higher tide from the U.S. stock market.
Hey, Mike, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Mike McGlone, Bloomberg Intelligence commodity strategist.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.